Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
My name is Mark Goulet, and I'm a professor of mathematics and associate dean in the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, your host for this program. Today, I'll be interviewing Brian Caffarella, professor in mathematics at Sinclair Community College in Dayton, Ohio, about his new book, Community College Mathematics, Past, Present, and Future, published by CRC Press, 2022, Brian addresses the key questions: how can we build a future model for community college gatekeeper math classes that is both successful and sustainable? Additionally, how can we learn from the past and the present to build such a model? From the 1970s to the pandemic in the early 2020s, the book uses interviews with 30 community college faculty members from seven community colleges to explore math curricula, as well as trends, initiatives, teaching practices, and mandates that have impacted community college mathematics. Dr. Brian Caffarella is a professor in mathematics at Sinclair Community College in Dayton, Ohio. He's taught a variety of courses, ranging from developmental math through pre-calculus. Brian is a past recipient of the Roush Award for Teaching Excellence and a past recipient of the Ohio Magazine Award for Excellence in Education. Brian, welcome to the program.
And thank you, Mark. I appreciate your having me today.
So to start, maybe we can begin with you telling us a little bit about yourself, maybe a bit about your professional journey to start, and then going into a bit about how you became interested in this particular project.
Sure. So I have been a teacher for 23 years. This will be my 24th year coming up. And I started off teaching middle school mathematics and reading, then moved up to high school, then to community college mathematics. But I really only became interested in research, I would say, within the last 10 years or so. And more specifically, I became interested in qualitative research, which is kind of unusual for a math person. Most people associate us with quantitative research, numbers, data, and whatnot. But I really became more interested in the how and the why when addressing these kind of imperative issues, especially with why students struggle so much in community college math. So my research interest is really focused on talking really with students, with faculty members about how we can improve the mathematical experience for students in community colleges, and what are the key issues we really need to address. So for this particular project, I got the idea from actually our college president, Dr. Steve Johnson. He had a focus group of faculty members a couple of years back, actually before the pandemic. And he was talking, Dr. Johnson was, about how as a school leader, his job is not simply, and this is the major misconception, his job is not just to manage the present. It's to it is to manage the present, but it's also to foresee and actually plan for the future. So for any program, for a school to be effective, or any program at a school to be effective, you have to manage the present, but you also have to foresee and plan for a successful future. So I got the idea of, well, how could we use what we've learned, because sometimes I feel that we don't learn enough from our history, what we've learned from the history, our present in community college math, to really plan for a successful future for students. So that's kind of where this really came together. And I'm thinking, okay, so in the end, how can I present some pathways to really help a diverse population of community college students succeed in math?
Thanks for that. I enjoyed the book. Maybe to conduct this discussion here, I'll walk through a little bit of your structure that you use in the book. As we've indicated, and as you've indicated, the qualitative nature of this work involved literally talking to people, to instructors who were really in the trenches teaching at community colleges from the 1970s through now. So a reasonable way to structure the book is to create chapters according to each of these decades, so we can begin early on with your interviews of faculty and discussions that emerged from those interviews who had experiences teaching community college math during the 1970s. Well, it goes back over 50 years or so. During that time, it was not unusual to refer to math classes as gatekeeper classes. Even then, you refer to it, in fact, in your describing the book. Can you say something about that? Just that terminology and its role. What are such courses? And maybe describe that a bit.
Well, and the term gatekeeper math courses, or even gatekeeper courses, really has been around since the 1970s. The term basically refers to courses, not just math, you could say general math, developmental math, English 101, Sociology 101, Psychology 101, classes that students have to successfully complete so that they can proceed and then eventually complete their college degree. So those courses that I've mentioned have typically been referred to as gatekeeper courses. In fact, the Achieving the Dream Initiative, which came about in the early 2000s, really focused specifically on gatekeeper courses. How can we help students succeed in these gatekeeper courses so that they can eventually progress and complete their college degree? Now, what's changed, I think, is the mindset. I mean, you go back to the 1970s, and I bet most folks can remember the first day of class, their professor saying, look to your left, look to your right. Some of these students will not be here at the end of the semester or quarter. And it's basically like sink or swim. I mean, the reality at that point was a certain percentage of students will not be successful. Fortunately, what's happened over time is the mindset has changed to how can we help retain students? How can we help students have better experiences in mathematics and eventually complete their degree? So the term really hasn't changed. The gatekeeper courses has been, and I think always will be, about these classes, these core requirements, if you will, that students have to complete general requirements, liberal arts requirements to complete their degree. But fortunately, again, what has changed is that mindset. We're no longer just accepting that, okay, a certain percentage will not be successful. It's become about what ways can we help these students succeed in these courses and beyond.
Right, right. Yeah, that's great. I mean, so a gate in a way that, you know, you're encouraging people to come to the gate. There's a path on the other side of the gate or through this gate that would lead to other opportunities, whether it's future coursework or future career choices or, just future knowledge they want to gain. And this course is kind of a critical part, initial entryway or path. Point in the path towards that. And I think you're right, Brian. I think we're both old enough, at least I'm old enough to recall my own education back in the 70s, where there might have been more of a focus on the keeping of the nature of the gate, and that there might have even been more a bit of a expectation that these courses might serve to some extent as filters. Versus, I think, what you're saying, which is currently the mindset amongst educators, very much so, is how do we keep the entry as open and as available as possible, so that we're encouraging students to move on. Further in that chapter, you introduce an organization to the reader. Some will be familiar with it. The acronym is AMATYC, A-M-A-T-Y-C. I believe an organization of instructors, faculty with interest in teaching. But maybe you can say a little bit more about the emergence of that organization and relation to the emergence of the profession, paying a little bit more attention to the art of teaching, pedagogy.
Well, I think what I found fascinating was, and this is probably something timeless, most teachers will want to teach their students the way they were taught. And that's not always a bad thing, because usually it's good teaching impressions that we think, okay, this is how we want to turn around and teach our students. And in the 1970s, faculty mentioned that they were used to just lecture-based instruction, 100% lecture-based instruction, very university-style instruction. You know, the class has 100, 150 students. The professor stands up in front of the room, talks for the entire length of class. You have to take notes, and then it's your responsibility to assimilate the content, take exams, and then move forward. But what the faculty in the 1970s started to question was, how can we better reach our students? So what can we do? What types of pedagogical practices can we use that we can reach this diverse population? Because what they were really discovering was the community college student population was very different from the university student population that they were used to when they were students. You had students that were coming in unprepared or underprepared. They needed a lot more assistance with their mathematics. So organizations, and that stands for the American Mathematical Association of Two-Year Colleges. That was an example of one organization that emerged in the late 1960s, early 1970s, and really focused on how can we help faculty members at two-year colleges reach students better? What pedagogical practices can we help faculty develop? And more importantly, AMATYC really kind of created a sense of community where faculty could talk with each other. That you just didn't get the impression that happened prior to the 1970s, where we actually got together and we talked about, students and mathematical practices and what can we do better. And okay, here's what is happening at this school. Is it something that we can try at our school? So it really, it helped faculty develop better pedagogical practices, but it also developed a sense of awareness as to what was going on and how we could better help students.
Yeah, organizations like this is a big step. Thank you, Brian. I mean, it is a big step to create something like that, that creation of community, a kind of community of scholars interested in their craft, so that you've recognizing that this is a unique population we're trying to serve. These are this is an interesting curriculum we're responsible for delivering. Let's give it some professional thought. Let's get together occasionally, maybe once a year, twice a year, regional, national conferences, discuss approaches, perhaps publish some of that, get it in front of other peers for review, and begin to practice kind of real efforts in a professional way that can assist us to improve our work, and in particular in this case, which would have direct impact presumably on the quality of the education that students would be receiving in the experience. So that's great. It's staying in the 70s, so we're still there. It's not unusual today. Some of our listeners will recognize the phrase emporium model for teaching what's known as a developmental mathematics class today. But your work reveals maybe that's not such a new concept, new to 2022 or the 2020s, but that began perhaps in the 70s.
Right. So the Emporia model was one of the major initiatives. I spoke earlier about the Achieving the Dream initiative, which basically set the goals of how can we help students better complete, the gatekeeper courses, but, you know, specifically developmental math and eventually community college, college level courses. But the Emporia model was a major initiative from the Achieving the Dream initiative. And basically the Emporia model, I mean, there's various ways you could use it, but it comes down to a self-paced model. You have students in a lab setting as opposed to a traditional classroom, where the instructor tends to be more of a facilitator as opposed to a lecturer or giver of information. So the students may watch videos and answer questions. As a result of those videos, the instructor, with maybe help of some tutors, will circulate throughout the room and answer questions kind of here and there. The big part of the Emporium model is students can work at their own pace. So students who may be more advanced can progress through a course at a quicker pace. And also students can focus on maybe content that is more difficult for longer periods of time. So for example, a student might not have as much difficulty with evaluating expressions in Introduction to Algebra, and they can move through that module or topic pretty quick. But they may struggle with factoring trinomials, and they may need to spend some sufficient time on factoring trinomials. So that's kind of what the Emporium model does. Is it really gives that kind of flexibility. And also, in terms of acceleration, as I mentioned a couple minutes ago, students can complete their math courses at a quicker pace. So they may even be able to complete two courses in one semester. But the reality was, yes, this was not really a new concept in the 2000s or early 2010s when it was stemming from Achieving the Dream. What I found is that this has really been around since the 1970s. Faculty were using various forms of the Emporia model in the 1970s, and it was really to help serve a diverse population, something that we're continuing to try to do today. Because what faculty were finding was, again, it was such a heterogeneous skill set. Faculty were attempting to teach developmental math courses, and there were students who really just needed a quick brush up on each topic. There were students who were really struggling in various topics. There were students who were really struggling in various basic topics like fractions and decimals and whatnot. So one faculty member mentioned that she became really overwhelmed with all of this and consequently put together kind of an Emporia model where, you know, students could work at their own pace and she could kind of move around to different parts of the room and help. So this is obviously way before the internet or any kinds of even VHS videos. So it was all worksheets, basically worksheets or workbooks that she came up with. So really it was just about the Emporia model really stemmed from trying to serve that diverse population.
Thanks. Yes, right. The technology may be different, but the idea, I think you, as you've described, is a relatively old one and an important one, trying to meet students where they are and not just assume that they're in a place where we're all at the same place and teach them all as if that's the case in that moment. Okay, so moving on then into the next chapter, you continue with your interviews, and I don't know if I'll specify. There are some people who remain. So you have a cadre of people, probably 30, that you talk to that constitute the interviews for the book, and some of those people taught in the 70s, and you continued, and they also, some of them continued teaching in the 80s. New people who you discovered started teaching in the 80s, you introduce into the interview stream, and you begin talking to that new group as well. So your interviews continue into the 80s, and there you mention observing the interviewers. The interviewees telling you that they're observing some curricular changes.
Absolutely. And yeah, that was kind of exactly as you mentioned it, Mark. I started with, a few faculty from the 1970s. I continued to gather their experiences in the 1980s and the future decades. But as each decade was introduced, so were a new cohort of faculty who were also starting in the 1980s. And when you looked at a developmental course, a developmental math course, a pre-college or remedial math course in the 1970s, oftentimes it was a combined arithmetic and pre-algebra, or almost arithmetic and algebra course together. So it was feasible that a student could start this course with whole numbers, adding, subtracting, multiplying, dividing, and then go all the way up into elementary algebra concepts by the end of the course. And what faculty were discovering was this was just simply too much because of the heterogeneous skill level, and also because of the fact that so many students were unprepared. So they were just losing so many students in this course. It was just too overwhelming for so many students. So their solution, and again, this really stemmed from the fact that faculty were talking with each other. They were talking with each other at their schools, at other institutions, again, organizations such as AMATIC. So what we started seeing in the 1980s was fragmenting, if you will, of these developmental math courses. So arithmetic and algebra would get split up, possibly even two arithmetic courses and an algebra course or a pre-algebra course. And the goal was to try to serve this diverse and heterogeneous group of students because the mindset was, hey, if students are really struggling with arithmetic, we need to have a course just on arithmetic. And then at the end of the course, test them on arithmetic, make sure that they have these arithmetic skills, which they do need before they can attempt pre-algebra. So it was really interesting to look at the curriculum of community college math curriculum that is in the 1970s and as time continued. Just something else that kind of interested me as well, how in a college algebra course, which is something you don't really see today, the topic of factorials, permutations, combinations, which is typically in a statistics course, was there. And I asked some of the faculty about that. And really, it came down to the fact that, yes, you use these concepts such as factorials for higher level math, in more abstract, but it took talking to each other again. It's something we kind of take for granted now, but it's important to remember that these lines of communication were being established at that point, talking to each other of like, well, maybe this is better in a statistics course, and maybe in a college algebra course, we need to focus more on these other topics, such as functions or conic sections. But it just fascinated me that it was the lines of communication that really established this as well.
Yeah, I think that's a great observation or a good discovery, because I think that shift of you were speaking to there is kind of what some might refer to as early combinatorics and so permutations and combinations are just ways to count, ways to count can get as we'll get quite sophisticated, but it has some very useful ideas that turn out to have good application. And a lot of what we're trying to do early on in teaching math at all stages, but is encourage logical thinking, reasoning, critical thinking, application of perhaps some of our problem solving skills in relation to that. The content sometimes can get very broad in that effort. And I think to some extent, teachers were thinking, we can get at some of these fundamental skills and take some of this content out to give ourselves time to have students work on these fundamental skills of reasoning and logic and algebra that really is going to be useful for, say, the pre-calculus class to come or the calculus class after that to come, and put out for now this notion of studying counting. And I think to this day, at least at our university, Brian, I can say we have a finite mathematics class. And I think in conversations with you earlier, you have such a class you're teaching this semester as well, that has remained, I think, as a fundamental course in our early curriculum, which is a result of moving some of this content from what used to be in an algebra class out into other classes that have, as you indicated, real usefulness specifically in an area like statistics or probability, but isn't necessarily needed for students, goes back to that path gate again, on that path that they might be on for taking this class, whether that be to become an engineer or a scientist or a psychologist is necessary at this time. So that's a great observation. The other part of the 80s that you've referenced is the way that calculators, I know that historically they probably came around a little sooner than the 80s. But they became a bit more ubiquitous maybe in our classrooms. Maybe you could say a little bit about that and the kind of challenges that brought for both instructors and students.
Well, it was interesting to talk with the faculty and really learn about just the evolution of the calculator in the mathematics classroom and the types of calculators, because really in the 1970s, as one faculty member mentioned, there were a few adding machines, and I did say that, adding machines, that were just simply passed around. So the times were just a lot simpler. So as the there's the four function calculator, the scientific calculator, then of course later the graphing calculator became available, they became more widely used. Cost was a major factor because clearly when these instruments first came out, the cost was too high. So the first really goal was for the cost to come down for students to be able to use them. And it was a challenge for faculty who had simply taught paper and pencil, no calculators, to really adapt to the scientific calculator, eventually the graphing calculator. One faculty member mentioned that it was almost like teaching a computer course using the graphing calculator with all these different keys, because not only are you teaching mathematics, which is no simple task, but you're all of these keys, and here's what you do now, and the syntax of how to enter data into the calculator. This was all challenging. And here is what I did find encouraging, and I think we can kind of this was really a flow or a thread from the 1970s, how faculty really continued to help each other. And we talked about AMATIC a little while ago, but even internally at their own schools, faculty continue to help each other. It always seemed like there was one or two faculty members who were ahead of the game in technology who could then reach out and help other faculty learn the scientific or the graphing calculator. But it was really overwhelming. And I think one faculty member mentioned kind of biting off more than they could chew. Like they kind of jumped right in and say, oh, I can use the I'll teach using the graphing calculator. But then it was like, well, there really is a steep learning curve to this graphing calculator. Maybe I'm not quite ready for this. I need to kind of step back and help myself prepare a little bit more. So it, but it's an example of just the just ever evolving use of technology that, you know, as faculty members, students, we just have to adapt. And we do that for the benefit of our students. We adapt, we learn, we adapt, and then we incorporate. So the examples, and again, they were really interesting stories about the emergence of the calculator. This is just going to be something that'll continue all through time. There'll always be new technology that we're going to need to incorporate. But as faculty members, it's really our responsibility to make sure that we really can learn, prepare, and teach adequately. One particular anecdote was one faculty member tried to incorporate the graphing calculator. It just wasn't going well. They stopped using it. Then obviously the students were kind of annoyed about this because it's like I paid a lot of money, over $100 for this graphing calculator, not using it in class. So it's really on us as faculty members to make sure that we are not only incorporating technology, but we are prepared as well. Oh, and I'll add one more thing too. The idea of uniformity as well became kind of a challenge, because with incorporating the calculators, it also became about, well, how can we have some kind of a uniform policy? Because it's not going to work very well if there's, let's say, a college algebra class and you have one faculty member that is allowing the use of a graphing calculator and another faculty member that's allowing no calculator. So that, and again, that's an ever-evolving challenge to make sure that we have some sort of uniformity to help benefit the students.
Thanks. So we'll move into the 90s. In the 90s, maybe you can say a little bit briefly about what changes emerged there. You mentioned some changes in the demographic of the student body, increased technology allowed for a different kind of perhaps distance education type approaches and those kinds of things.
Yeah, faculty mentioned how in the 1990s, and I did ask this question, that when did they notice the population, the community college population, becoming even more diversified? Several faculty mentioned in the 1970s, even though the skill level was very heterogeneous, it was typically a white 18 or 19 year old. White male, female, 18, 19-year-old, right out of high school. Whereas as the 80s and then into the 90s, basically the demographics became more diversified. Started seeing more Black and Hispanic ESL students, also non-traditional students, that is students coming back to school in their 20s, 30s, 40s, even older. And part of that was also the need. I thought this was kind of interesting, where one faculty member mentioned how really by the 1990s, having a college degree was almost like what having a high school degree once was. It was just a necessity. You just had to have a college degree to get any kind of a good job or just a career and to be able to advance in your career. So it really became a necessity. Having a college degree. And I think it took some time for the whole idea of open access, which is what community colleges are, to really catch on, even though that had been the case for many years. It was almost like more and more people were saying, oh, I can go to community. I didn't know this. I could go to community college. And high schools were also saying that as well. It's like, okay, well, even though you haven't had the best experience academically, you can go to community college and maybe there's something for you there. So more and more people started, even though the doors had always been open, it took some time to realize that these doors had been open. So we really started seeing more of a diverse population. And yes, as the technology evolved, that opened doors as well. It was really fascinating to hear in the 1990s, especially from the faculty who had taught since the 1970s, their first experience with emailing. Some didn't like it. They just found it very impersonal. And online learning, which really started as more of a correspondence type of a learning, obviously before the internet became widely used, they just found that very impersonal, the idea of online learning, because I'm not really speaking with my students. I'm not really meeting with my students as much. We're just communicating via email. So that in itself you know, took some adaption from the faculty as well. And then also what we started seeing at the K-12 level in mathematics education was something referred to as math wars. And that stemmed from the from NCTM, the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics. They're a very big organization with a lot of say, so to say, in the K-12 mathematics. And really, there was a report in 1989, basically stated that students really struggle with abstract concepts in mathematics. So they may have these rotary skills, computational skills, but they struggle in problem-solving skills, critical thinking, as you mentioned a little while ago. So we need to focus more on project-based learning, service learning, learning through application. Rather than like a traditional lecture, the instructor needs to be more of a facilitator. So that really started what were these math wars, where you had folks who were more on the traditional side of, we need to make sure that students have a basic grounding, fundamental knowledge in mathematical skills before they can apply these skills, as opposed to, no, students really need to learn through application. But what was interesting is how these math wars eventually moved their way up to community college math, as we'll see in the 2000s.
Yes, I can speak directly to that. Not just community college math, Brian. I speak as a faculty member spending my professional life in undergraduate four-year institutions, present there as well, and emerging in the 90s. And there was some also the tension of, like you said, what level of technology should one use? What level of engagement should you have in a classroom? What lecture time are you going to give up for that kind of effort or pedagogical approach? And there was a passionate debate on those kinds of issues. So moving then into the 2000s, you mentioned that it seemed to you from your interviews that, and from your research, that you observed perhaps professionals paying a little bit more attention to the data that they were collecting on the work that was happening in their classrooms and how their students were progressing.
Well, and the emphasis on data collection really came more from state legislatures and eventually administrators. Initially in the 1970s, the goal was let's just serve as many students as we can in community colleges. And regarding developmental math, it's okay, we're just going to try to help as many as we can. We know that a significant portion won't make it. We were talking about that with the gatekeeper courses, and that's okay. But it's also important to remember that funding for public institutions of higher education in the 1970s really was more about enrollment and what's called the full-time equivalency, basically number of full-time loads that students were taking. And that was it. There wasn't really any kind of emphasis on success rates. You know, how are students succeeding in these math classes? That came a little bit later on, where legislatures started asking questions of, okay, so we're paying all this money for students to go to school, taxpayers are as well. How are they doing? Well, not very well. They're not completing. Is there a reason they're not completing? Mathematics. Okay, so what about mathematics? Developmental mathematics. And then developmental mathematics, well, they're large numbers of students are testing into developmental math. They're not getting out. Therefore, they're not completing. And then it became the issue of, well, developmental math, this is the content that they were supposed to have learned in K-12, which we're also paying for. So we're basically paying for them to learn it twice, and they're not learning it even once. So that really stemmed from state legislatures, the focus on lack of success rates, lack of completion, that trickled to college, community college administrators, which then trickle down to faculty. So what we saw in the 2000s was many initiatives that really focused on how can we help students complete. I mentioned the Achieving the Dream initiative a little while ago, which was geared at these gatekeeper courses and how can we help students become more successful. Because what was also happening was the funding formulas, if you will, for public institutions of higher education began to change. It wasn't so much about how many students do you have, your FTEs, full-time equivalency. It became about how many students are completing. So that in itself provided some initiative for community colleges to help students complete at a quicker pace. But yes, we started seeing really in the 2000s more emphasis on various initiatives to help students complete. So that's also, we were talking about the Emporium model a little while ago. That's where the Emporium model really resurfaced because it was, okay, students can accelerate. They have the potential to accelerate through their coursework at a quicker pace, which means less time in developmental math because one major statistic that came up was the more or longer of a developmental math sequence that the student has to complete, the less likely they are to complete. So how can we get these students through their developmental math courses at a quicker pace? So that's what we really started seeing more in the 2000s, these many, many initiatives to help students have a better mathematical experience.
Yeah, and that brings us to even some things that go on today, and I'll just mention a few things because you mentioned them in the book at various places, and just ask so that you could describe briefly to the listener some of these concepts. The concept of what seems to emerge in support of a model like an Emporium model is the notion of supplemental instruction. Maybe you can describe a bit what that is.
And that was one, and supplemental instruction had been around a while, actually going back to the 1970s as well. But that in addition to the Emporium model, really emerged in the 2000s as well. Valencia Community College in Florida is kind of looked at, even though supplemental instruction wasn't new, as somewhat of a pioneer, if you will, in the 2000s, or I guess maybe a more modern version of supplemental instruction. And supplemental instruction, basically, you will see this for developmental math courses, possibly introductory math courses, where in addition to class time, students will attend possibly one or two extra sessions per week. possibly 50 minutes at a time. And these sessions, supplemental instruction, or SI for short, SI sessions, are facilitated by a tutor. And the tutor is also known as an SI leader or SI coordinator. The tutor basically, in the traditional model, will actually attend the class to, first of all, gauge what the students are learning, but also the instructor's teaching style, maybe what the students are struggling with and whatnot. And the SI sessions are review sessions that really enhance what the students have. So, for example, factoring trinomials, solving quadratic equations. Will basically review this content. The SI leader may use class discussions, collaborative learning, group work, just extra hands-on practice to really help the students. And SI has proven effective. And it's not, I would say, some of the initiatives I discuss in the book are controversial. This SI really isn't controversial. It's one of those initiatives where just about everybody supports it. The major debates or questions have been the logistics of it. So should SI be mandatory or voluntary? And the data show that it really should be mandatory, because one age-old concept with developmental students is they don't do optional. And when schools attempted to make supplemental instruction optional, it was still effective. Just far too few students actually took advantage of it. So logistically, it can be harder to make it mandatory, because you have to work with registration to make sure that when students register for this math class, let's say intermediate algebra, they're also registering for this specific SI session, so that they're with the same cohort of students, so that this same SI instructor who's attending the class is also leading it. So logistically, it can be more difficult, but it has proven more effective when it is mandatory.
That's helpful. I mean, and I think that's a great point. You know, learning anything, real learning is hard by sort of definition. You know, I think of sort of mathematicians being one of them. You kind of work through your discipline like a bead on a string, and if you're flying along, everything's fine and you're moving, but it's not until you hit a knot and you stop and you can't go until you untangle that knot that you're really doing mathematics. But that's a frustrating moment at the same time, because you're not flying along like you were before. And to find ways to help our students who are inevitably going to encounter that same path, that same experience in learning mathematics, to develop the persistence, the acknowledgement that it's not supposed to just be snap your finger, move on, but that there's some real learning that's taking place there. And I think supplemental instruction has a really great role to play in that regard, because it can take some of that time for students and assist them in those times when they're facing something a bit more challenging.
And I'll just add one thing too, that I think another thing with the supplemental instruction is the engagement as well. You know, the fact that the SI session should not be about just re-lecturing, if you will, the content. It's engaging the students in discussions, group work, kind of that one-on-one help, which again was such an important thread that I found, is just engaging students.
Right. Really engaging in problem solving, which is the point of mathematics and logical reasoning. You've mentioned it already, but at this point, you know, we're well into the 2000s in the book. Online learning today is ubiquitous. It's the technology is rich, available. What impact has that had on community college teaching of mathematics?
Well, it was really incredible to, first of all, read the research, talking with faculty, how online learning through the late 90s into the 2000s really just exploded. I mean, I discussed the data, the numbers in the book, and how it just really it increased exponentially. It really did. And it was that was really because of student needs and serving the diverse population, in that you had students going back to school, having families, and really just needing more of a flexible schedule where they could take their classes. And just in previous research, I've also found too how there's just so many ways that online learning serves this diverse population. I was speaking with one student in a previous research project who mentioned that she went back to school being agoraphobic. She because of some past experiences, she was afraid to leave the house really and go to places with crowds of people. And how if it wasn't for online learning, she would not have been able to successfully complete her math requirements. So it was just another one of the many examples of online learning of how community colleges have continued to serve that diverse population. But the challenge has been to embed material in these online classes that will help the students and also keep up with the times. That was something faculty were struggling with online or distance learning in the early 2000s of are our materials, is our pedagogy dated? Again, online learning or distance learning even started with students really just watching these videos. And then from these VHS even, and then eventually CD-ROM, and answering questions. So how can we make it more interactive? And that's when we started seeing software programs such as MyMathLab, it's now called MyLabMath, Alex, interactive programs where students could basically answer a math question and then get instant feedback, along with possibly seeing some videos, and in the process, maybe sending their professor a question, while actually doing all of this. So that's kind of been the challenge, I think, with online learning, and it's going to continue to be the challenge. Even as we move through the 2020s, to really ensure that the technology is meeting the needs of the students and clearly and engaging the students as well. That tended to be a threat as well, is making sure that we're engaging the students as much as we can. Going back to like the 1990s, faculty were kind of frustrated that they didn't have that engagement and interactiveness with the students that they once had. So faculty mentioned that it's also important that instructors reach out to students in various ways, even in their online courses, to make sure, is there anything more I can do for you? Are you struggling with anything? Kind of have that humanistic approach. And then as we look forward into the 2020s, it's just amazing to think of the technology that'll continue to impact online learning. I mean, I can sit here right now and say that I think artificial intelligence is going to play a major role, going forward. So that's going to be the continued challenge of online learning in terms of serving students with the up-to-date technology, but again, engaging them and kind of connecting with them in that human way.
I've got a couple more questions maybe before we start to move towards wrapping up. The last piece, there were some things you mentioned along the way in the book. There's a lot in the book. One organization that you reference is Complete College America. And maybe you can say something about that. The late 2008, 2009, sounds like you mentioned the introduction of that organization.
So Complete College America formed or were funded by, I should say, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation really took an interest in community colleges, community college math, helping students complete. And this specific organization, Complete College America, or CCA for short, and actually Stan Jones was the kind of founding CEO, if you will. This organization really focused not just on helping students in America complete college, but also look at more groundbreaking ways and through educational reform. So not just helping students complete, but what could we do differently that we haven't done before to help students complete. The major role that Complete College America is really impacting community college math, and this is kind of a contemporary issue, is the idea of standalone developmental math. Complete College America is actually advocating for the removal of standalone developmental math. Moreover, that students should, regardless of skill level, start in a college level course, college algebra, quantitative reasoning, introduction to statistics, with a co-requisite. In other words, they have this just-in-time remediation. So at the same time they're taking this college-level course, they're taking this remedial course or remedial component that is basically at the same time, synchronously, preparing them for the content that they're learning in the college-level course.
Yes, you're right. That is a significant point of conversation happening today and with varying levels of agreement and disagreement with the idea of what that would mean. Another challenge facing community colleges today is an idea known as dual enrollment. Maybe you can say a little bit about what that is and what impact that has on today's community colleges.
So with dual enrollment, this allows us, and this is something that grew throughout the late 20th century into the 21st century. It's become a major initiative in many community colleges where high school students can complete college level courses while they are in high school. And oftentimes these are these gatekeeper or core requirement courses, math, English, psychology. So when these students graduate high school, they have accumulated a fair amount of college level credits as well. So when they begin their college endeavor, they're ahead in the gang, and there have been many cases where students have actually graduated high school and have even completed an associate degree. So they've kind of completed their basic requirements as well. And the findings from dual enrollment have largely been positive, in that it really helps students. First of all, it gives students an option. I mean, possibly that maybe they didn't want to go to college or whatnot, that it gives them an interest in higher education. So they are more likely to continue or attend college because they have started their courses already. It gives them kind of a sense of direction in their lives for possibly a future career. And it also helps the students early on acclimate to college life. In other words, some students get kind of shell-shocked or they're in culture shock when they go from high school to college, in that it's so much more rigorous. The requirements are so much more rigorous. So they learn about these rigors while they're in high school, and they are so much better prepared for college.
So, Brian, you spend a lot of time talking to 30 instructors and reading a lot of instruction over the last – of instructors who spent time teaching over the last 50 years, community college mathematics. What would you say, where does that bring us today? What takeaways can we get from those conversations you've had? I put you on the spot. What's your take on the teaching of developmental math today, what have we learned? What can we take away?
I mean, it's just really that was. I mean, if the question was ever, usually people will ask, what did anything surprise you in your research? And I don't know if even surprise is the right word, but I was just amazed at so much we can learn from the history of this discipline. Now, with standalone developmental math, in other words, should that be eliminated? I disagree with that, especially with speaking with the faculty, looking at the data. And I mean, history really shows us that standalone developmental math is needed for many students. Now, on the one hand, we did put students through too many long, unnecessary math pathways. In other words, at one time they started, if they placed into arithmetic, they had to travel through these long sequences of arithmetic, elementary algebra, or introduction to algebra, elementary algebra, intermediate algebra, just to pass college algebra, and many of them didn't make it. And the reality was college algebra is not applicable to many students. College algebra really prepares students for calculus. If you're not going into a science, technology, engineering, or mathematical field, college algebra really isn't for you. That's in itself something that we've learned. But there are students who really do need the skill set that a developmental math course will teach them. Especially in this age when we were focusing so much on equity and serving that diverse population, it's almost unfair to put some students directly into a college-level math course. And co-requisites have proven successful. I mean, co-requisites, students have said a couple things with co-requisites. Number one, it's so great that I can, rather than two semesters, in one semester, I can focus on this remedial content and then take my college level course. So it saves me the time. They also like the applicability of it, that I'm applying this remedial knowledge right away. So an example of that is in the quantitative reasoning course, they focus on debt to income ratio problems. Debt to income ratio problems require the ability to solve algebraic equations with fractions. And that's a remedial concept. So you can learn, the student can learn about this concept, algebraic fractions, in the remedial course, then apply it to debt-to-income ratio problems in quantitative reasoning. So there have been so many positives, but co-requisites in themselves just don't have the bandwidth to help all students. There are some students who really need extensive practice in basic skills such as solving linear equations, evaluating expressions, you know, these basic concepts. There are students who really need extensive practice in arithmetic, and that's something else I addressed too, that that's kind of, I fear, kind of fallen by the wayside in our contemporary outlook in math, is that we have students that really have deficient arithmetic skills. So I talk about that as well, and maybe some pathways that schools can use to help these students as well. So I think the whole idea is, especially sticking to that model of a diverse population and having all of these options. So I also think it's about finding a balancing act. I mean, yes, on the one hand, we don't want to put all of these students through these long sequences of math courses, especially just to get to college algebra. But at the same time, how can we make sure that they're prepared for the course that they need to take so that they don't struggle, which will inevitably wind up in them probably dropping out and, of course, not completing. So I think I would say within a year, especially for the non-math major or non-science major, it's feasible that they can take a standalone pre-algebra course if they need to, not all of them need to, but if they need to, then in the next semester, take the quantitative reasoning with a co-requisite, or the statistics with a co-requisite. And in that year's time between the standalone course, the statistics or quantitative reasoning course, again, with the co-requisite, they will have completed their math requirements. So that was a big purpose as well, as to how can we find that balancing act so that we are not going through these long sequences, but we're making sure that students are prepared. So I really feel that in the final chapter of the book, I'm able to address that as well. How can we really serve these students going forward? What are some pathways going forward that are going to serve these this diverse population of students?
Yeah, I think you do, Brian. Thank you. So, in conclusion, what are you up to now? I know we've talked a little bit. You're starting a semester at Sinclair on Monday. Monday as we speak here, so it'll be in just a couple of days for you. But besides that, what's your next project?
So I'm thinking, I took this past summer off. This book went into print May of 2022. So I was Definitely, there was a lot of research in this book. So, and actually, I had written a book prior to this, Breaking Barriers, and then I went from that book right to this book. So I kind of needed some time to kind of decompress over the summer, spent a lot of time at the pool watching professional baseball, just kind of kicking back. But I am looking at, for the next project, a self-help book. For students, so kind of a little bit of a different direction here. In other words, a student is going back to school. They're nervous as heck about taking a math course in this day and age. What tools could we give to this student? I'm starting off. I want to go back to college, but I'm scared to death of math. And you know, I'm looking at a book that will be kind of a guide to this student. Of, you know, what can you do to prepare yourself? What can you do to navigate the process? So I'm really looking forward to getting into that.
That sounds great. Look forward to that. What about for the listeners, where can they find the book?
The Community College Math, Past, Present, and Future is on Amazon. That's probably the easiest way. That's typically everybody's go-to site. If you go to Amazon, Brian Caffarella, Community College Mathematics. It is also on the publisher site on the Rutledge Publish, which is kind of the parent publishing company for CRC Press. So Rutledge Publishing. If you Google Brian Caffarella, Community College Mathematics, it comes up in various sites as well. In fact, sites that I've honestly never even heard of. I was amazed at all the different places. But I think Amazon is probably the go-to site. And I think for students who are going to be using it in their graduate work, eCampus is a resource as well.
Okay. Well, Brian, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Well, thank you very much. This has been great. I appreciate you having me.